Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on Kaechang Radio, Chinatown's only micro broadcasting radio station. My name is Nicholas Miller. I am not here as of late with Steve Cato.
No, we are still at, we've moved. We're now at, what's it called? La Strada in Beverly Hills. We've moved down the coast.
Yeah, yeah.
From French Laundry. We're now...
We're just taking a whole tour of the, civic leaders' favorite dining spots during the lockdown.
It's nice here. They have a great chopped salad here at La Strada, I hear.
Yeah, and they've even got an ice fountain.
They have an ice fountain, and they are apparently doing a New Year's Eve COVID-free speakeasy. Ooh. So, prohibition themed. Make sure to tell all your friends to come and get the new excellent English strain of coronavirus.
Oh,
at La Strada.
Okay, yeah.
Beverly
Very
Hills.
Tasty indeed.
It's a really good strain.
Yeah. Well, and it's particularly potent. Comes, with herd immunity built in. That's the Brits were way out ahead of that program.
Yeah, if you live, it will be great for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Return all your scented candles when you come back from La Strada because you won't be needing them.
Yeah, you won't even smell them.
That shit's over.
Yeah. And, you couldn't taste them before anyway, so.
Yeah. I'm sure not, I don't think this is something I have ever done. If I have, I don't remember it, but I'm sure someone's been like, man, this scented candle smells so good. I wonder what it tastes like. I'll just have a little nibble of this scented candle. I'm sure someone's done that.
Well, I did notice recently that C. Ray Trudon now sells these little like bars. They're not candles and they're not soap either. They're just like little scented bas relief bars. And those seem tasty.
Like, so it's just like wax.
Yeah, with like a very nice little, sculpted face in it of some aristocrat or something.
Oh, wow.
But I think the way that most heavily scented candles within like a 1 meter radius, you can still catch a whiff. I think that's the idea.
Yeah.
Like put them at the bedside table.
Yeah. So you don't need to have smoke in your room, but you can have all the smell.
Yeah.
The smells.
Yeah. It's just like, like most things these days, it's about eliminating risk.
Yes, if candles are too risky because of fire, you can always rely on just having like a wax object nearby, a scented wax object.
Yeah, the feeling of the idea of a scented candle.
Maybe you're supposed to. Maybe you're supposed to use it to seal your letters.
Oh, yeah.
Like you melt it in another candle, in the heat of another candle, and then drizzle it on and stamp it, and then you're... the person who's lucky enough to be receiving a letter from you, is like cracking open the seal on this letter, being like, oh, look, it smells good.
Unfortunately, I've been using it to seal my emails. It hasn't been so effective.
Oh, boy, that was a cheap laugh.
yeah, take what you can get these days.
Discount price. Yeah. So what's been new with you this week?
It's been a pretty relaxing week. I always relish the week between Christmas and New Year's. Relatively light Christmas with the parents because of this virus that's going around. So, outdoor afternoon hangouts for a few hours, and then my partner in crime doesn't celebrate Christmas, so very little pressure on that end. and Hanukkah is a very light holiday in the Jewish calendar.
It's not even real. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was some candles that burned too long or something at some point, right?
It was a lamp.
It was a lamp, right. Okay, the oil.
Sure. Yeah, but it's essentially like a drama of like your utilities being better than you thought they were. Like your utility hookup is really working.
Yeah.
And they're like, that's cool.
Right.
That's, like the it's deemed to be holy,
Like early solar.
Yeah, or like we thought they would cut off the electricity, but it turns out that's fake.
Yeah.
You know, like they don't cut off utilities, you know, like they just say that they will. Takes them a long time to send a guy around, you know, especially given that we're operating in, you know, such a period of full austerity.
Yeah.
So, you know, rather than have an employee come in, it takes a while for an employee to come do it, is basically the message.
Sure. Yeah.
An employee of Yahweh came around and eventually turned off the oil in the lamps, but he took a lot longer to do it than they thought, and it was deemed miraculous.
The miracle of lazy utility guys.
No, totally. Yeah. The public servant who is not doing his job.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's been about it. How about you?
Yeah. Also pretty chill. Yesterday, we had that crazy rainstorm on Monday.
That was wild.
That was like,
I didn't know what the whole day. What thunder was.
It was wild. Yeah. You have a million things you can imagine it is instead. You're like, oh, the garbage cans are being moved.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's an earthquake. You're like, no, that's just thunder. It's just like, it's going to happen on and off all day. But it really did happen, you know, more or less all day, except for a little, at least where we were, like a little bit in the morning.
Yeah, I heard it mostly around 2 or 3 in the morning.
It cleared up like around 8 or something like that, where we were. The sun fully came out and everything. But then by 10 it started raining again,
right?
And then it was like on and off, varying degrees of intensity all day, and the cats hid and the cats came out and the cats hid. But it's something else, you know. Yeah, you're just not used to it, you know, and you expect I guess at the time that it was happening, we didn't even leave the house once. Like, I unlocked the door from the inside for the first time yesterday, like at around 10 o'clock when I took out the cat poo, you know, scraped the litter boxes before going to bed. And that was that. You know, we had really, no one had gone out all day. And, you know, you look at, I remember other days when it rains less, you know, like the 10 fills up with water and, you know, there's like all kinds of weird pooling water and flooding and stuff like that all over the place. So I think it was good that we stayed in.
Mm-hmm.
But you weren't out in the rain at all yourself.
No, I just scuttled between the house and the garage, but that wasn't enough to really... I was surprised that Chiquita went outside for most of it.
Really?
Yeah. When you're in the kitchen and you're doing the dishes and you get a little water on her, it's kind of like she's been... You poured acid all over her. You know? But then she just
ran. Was she wet when she came in?
Yeah, she just ran right out into the rain, was just standing in it. I thought, well, okay, Chiquita, next time I actually spray you during the dishes, we're going to have a little talk.
Yeah, this performance doesn't work anymore.
I mean, she would scuttle to like under the cars and stuff like that, but it was raining hard enough that she got wet, you know, and there were cute little wet cat paw prints all throughout the house.
It is really cute.
Yeah.
There was a moment before the holidays when my spouse was preparing like a fine baked good, and there was with holiday intent, and there was like some cat left like one paw print on like a sheet cake.
Ooh.
Just like a little single paw impression on the cake as it was like investigating what was like cooling or whatever.
Meow.
Around the house. Yeah, I know. It's really funny. Because, you know, it's like some things really do look like it's like the most pure form of indexical sign. You know, you're like, a cat stood here.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, they'll have to update. I feel like there's the famous essay in art history about the footprints in the sand. They'll have to update it.
Yeah, there's one cat taking one paw on a sheet cake.
Yeah, the beaches are closed, guys.
The beaches are closed. But the mall is still open. Please come to the mall.
Right.
by all means, come to the mall.
Yeah.
So speaking of sort of the polyacoustic surround sound environment that is the Glendale Galleria, I mean, or rather, sort of the Americana brand or mm-hmm. the Grove, are two most successful regional malls.
Yep.
Is that a decent segue into am I reaching here?
Yeah. I don't think our guest tonight would appreciate Frank Sinatra swirling around your psychoacoustic space, but that's as good as it gets for us here in 2020. And these days, only if you're lucky, you know.
Yeah.
Lucky enough to be chock full of antibodies and to go out and get a funnel cake or a Parisian waffle cone.
Or, you know, even if you're not, just risk it. Just go do it. Keep the economy afloat.
Yeah,
don't be a wimp. do it for the economy.
Yeah,
friend.
Yeah. The lung donor sheet's real short. So anywho, tonight we have a pre-recorded lecture. You know, this is a tragedy of the times. We have to do pre-recordings now. Of the incredible, radical, revolutionary, I'd say, composer Marion Amishe.
I would like to... is the microphone working all right?
Yeah,
okay. I would like to speak this morning on first on two aspects in my sound work and how I feel that today's programmable technology really it affects and advances this kind of work. The first is maybe the simplest to explain, and that has to do with the structure of music over time. And it became very interesting to me when I began my first work, which was in 1967, actually. I began working with telecommunications resources. And at this time, I created a piece for an FM radio station in Buffalo, New York. Perhaps you know of the Center for the Creative and Performing Arts was an organization that invited various guest composers from all over the world. It was very active for a while. So I was one of them, and at that time, I installed microphones in 8 different remote locations in the area, and then 15,000 hertz dedicated telephone lines to the microphones, and the sound came live to the radio station for a 28-hour broadcast where I was mixing these various remote sources. And the sound for this particular production was close mic'd. The microphones were close to the sound sources, and they were different in environments in the local Buffalo area. And after that, I became very interested in using this technology to make deeper studies in my studio. I was at MIT for a period of time, for a period of 4 years, at the Center for Advanced Visual Studies. And while I was there, I installed a microphone at the Boston Harbor. And for me, this was a really wonderful resource for studio studies. The microphone was connected to my studio, again, with a dedicated high quality radio telephone line for approximately 3 years. And it came into my mixing board, and I could walk into my room, and particularly late at night, it was when I was most interested, after midnight, 12 o'clock, when things really quieted down. And I could then begin to absorb it was one factor of living with this live sound like this, almost the way you would turn on your radio or turn on records. I was able to live with this, but what was important to me is that I really learned what interested me, and I had no way to learn this in music. I learned about spatial perception and spatial dimension in sound. I could hear sound very far away and close up, things disappearing and appearing, and these are factors in my music and when I began that interested me, but in our musical, traditional musical presentations, usually everything is on a stage or in one place. So it's actually, it wasn't that I wanted the sounds of birds or the sounds of the harbor or any of these sounds. I really wanted much more to experience and learn about hearing and how, so that I could make an interval or I could make an instrument in my music that perhaps had some kind of similarity to the dimensions that we actually hear in life. And I think it's one extension when John Cage talked about the sounds around us. My interest is much more in how we as human perceivers are experiencing these sounds, and that's really what's in the environment for me that interested me. And as I said, I'm not so interested in the sounds themselves. So with this same installation in my studio that I could make these studies and observe things, I could also use this live sound from the harbor in other shows and other installations in other cities. While this was installed, I did another radio production for WBAI in New York, where the sound from Boston and the sound from the New York harbor were then sent to Radio Music France. And this was a half hour live broadcast. And I made a variety of different installations with this, and that to me is very convenient. I think it's a nice thing. It's like the fax machine now. You just hook up a telephone line, the sound comes into your studio, you go to Australia, you know, all you need is the money to rent the line to bring this other environment or this other world, whatever it is that you would like to your performing situation. So in this period of time, I made some 21 of these different installations of live sound in different places, in museums, and in radio stations. But I think the most valuable thing to me about it were really these. Of course, it's always nice to have in a performance, but it was really these situations in my studio, both in Boston and in New York, when I had the sound coming in and I could analyze it and experience it and learn about dimension in sound. So after this period of work, I began, then as the computer programs became more possible, and we now have them in the world, and it also makes things much easier for us, it affected my thinking about structure, and I described these environmental works in order to give you some background to how I think about musical structure now. It became important to me. In my installations and performances, I've tried to stage the sound whenever I can architecturally, and the idea of that is getting the sound to circulate in the structure of the room within the building, and often I like to make works that involve more than one room. And these works are called Music for Sound Join Rooms. And in these instances, I will have several rooms and I will install the sound. And it's what acousticians refer to as structure-borne sound when that happens, which is interesting to me because if you play two speakers in a room and you're playing the tone middle C and the sound goes directly out into air, the middle C, the wavelength for middle C is 4 feet 4 inches, you know, about this big. If it's traveling through the wood or a stone also, the speed of sound is much faster. So that same middle C is no longer 4 feet in wavelength. It is actually 19 feet, and the wave is much larger. And of course, as the sounds get lower, they are even much larger than that. And intuitively, I didn't realize this in the beginning. I just staged my sound this way because I preferred hearing it than having it in the room directly in air. And later, I realized this factor, and it makes quite a difference, I think, in experiencing music. So as a result of these architectural stagings, in which I have staged the music as much as possible structurally and made sets, I realized as a result of present day technology something quite interesting, that really in a few years, I mean, right now we have samplers that can do everything, but in an well, probably in a matter of 2 years, there'll be very good variation makers. So what that means is really, it can take my music, a variation maker, and perhaps in a few years later, people will have in their homes these same variation makers, and very extended a program will be available to make quite wonderful variations of everyone's music, and it will be very simple. So where does that leave someone who's actually seriously working in the profession of music? If this becomes so available and so possible, so then to resolve this problem, I think that the whole idea of structure of music over time, or the flow, or the distribution of worlds, or changes of sound becomes very important, because that's a more difficult thing to actually design a little program for. Someone has to really, beforehand, imagine it, perhaps eventually very interesting knowledge will develop about creating changes in creating worlds. Maybe somewhere in the late 1990s, but right now it doesn't exist. You can take any form of minimal music. I mean, it's nothing to just sample this, and it will be not difficult to make any variation. So if you're actually making something, I don't know, there's just not much point unless maybe you're doing something that takes 3 weeks before a new software can actually be invented to make a variation or duplicate your work. So because of this factor, I then became interested in making what I call dramatic forms in space, in which there are extreme changes through the structure in time. And this description relates to the work that I'm presenting here, which I call a mini sound series. And I adapted this idea from television and from comic books, because I think the form is really very interesting. And I think it's unfortunate that we exist in the world and in whatever our musical tradition is, and the idea is you go in one night and you do a performance and you leave and people get like it and get excited or they hate it or whatever. And this is the way it goes. But on the other hand, television and comic books have something that's very involving. The stories continue, the music continues, and I didn't realize all this when I began. My first mini sound series was in San Francisco, and it was a 6-part, and it was distributed over 6 weeks, which for me I think is the most interesting way of presenting these works, because people hear them, they go away, if they want to come back they tell other people. A real kind of dialogue gets set up. It's as though you become interested in a story on television and you look at it next week, or you don't. My experience, it was a wonderful relationship with the audience in almost every one of these I have done, that if I'd come to this situation and had done 2 separate concerts, it would not, I don't think it would have, for me, I don't think it would have been as meaningful as this idea that you leave, and even though the piece isn't continuing, audibly, it still exists. And my reason for, I chose also to do this because I was interested in a form that was not a continuous installation, which of course we have now very many in the world, continuous sound installations, sound art, nor a conventional concert format. So with the mini sound series, I'm able to make something that does evolve over time, and I'm able to make a story, and I'm able to explore these dramatic changes of music over time that I spoke of earlier, that I think because of, to me, becomes important because of existing technology and because someone's going to make a software to make a variation of my music in a few days. And so I would like to create something that maybe makes that just a little more difficult to discover the laws of structure. And so afterwards there can be a question period about the ideas of structure that I'm just talking about. And the second advantage for me of, and how I approach programmable instruments, is what now I just call the listener's music. And this is a topic that's been buried really forever until now. That's the factor that we as listeners, as human beings, when we hear, on the most simple case, 2 sine waves, 2 sine tones, we immediately create 3 more quite obvious tones in our ears. And in all orchestral music and all music, this happens, and it happens on a subliminal level, and it probably happens a lot really in good performances, that really sensitive performers and musicians are experiencing these maybe more vividly, and they're hearing them, and perhaps it explains one of the reasons that people might respond more to, it's one of the factors, not one of the reasons really, but one of the factors that might make a performance a little more moving or more special to people experience it, because the performer has really enhanced these things in whatever, from his piano playing or from the conductor, from the orchestra. And So now, with programmable technology, we can actually study these. Before I started first doing it with just oscillators, and of course that's very difficult, but now it's quite simple to make. I have a program that, unfortunately I brought some samples, but I can't show them on the, this is a different overhead, but I have a simple program that says, let me hear X, and maybe you can see, I can show you later. X would be this low tone right here, this low D. And here is a sample of just a few intervals. And so in my program, the person goes to the computer and specifies one tone that he wants to examine as it appears as a first order difference tone, second or third order. And then the program sounds whatever intervals, if you wish to examine the third, fourth, fifth octave in whatever tuning system you might want, the program then sounds those intervals, and you can sit back and see how the tone quality of this D on this page, differs from in the different intervals that you actually hear it. And so to me, this is really a very exciting feature to be able to have a program that does this. And it's very simple, but it enables me to really investigate these in a way that could never happen before. And then a second program enables me to enhance, to select from these combinations and reinforce and enhance these kind of tones that are in, let's say, a body of timbre or a body of music that I've created. I'm able to bring out certain tones this way from using this basic material. And I think just, well, besides these technical factors, I think it's really a curious issue because, as I said, this has been buried for years and years, and it's called psychoacoustic phenomena. The tones that we make as human responders, they really are response tones that we really stand or sit or whatever when we're experiencing music, and we are creating other tones that go along with the tones that are sounding. And I think in the early days, like in Vivaldi, you hear a lot of this in Vivaldi's music before, and also before notation really got off, people, the musicians probably gave a lot of attention to this. But then the notation started to become very important, and so it was only the notes that are sounding in the room, which I call the A tones, the acoustic tones. The B tones are here, the C tones are here, which I haven't discussed yet. But and so to me, it's so incredible because it seems like in all our music background, I don't know what we learn really. It's as though when I was studying music, to learn about overtones, to learn about the physics of sound was like something only for scientists. It was, you were to psychoacousticians. And so what you, in my musical background, really what I was learning was now what samplers do, simply to rearrange the patterns and the figures of really other men's music and make a personalized form of this for myself. I wasn't learning anything about these very basic physics. And it's not that I wanted to know that much, but there are certain things that we exist in this world, and that for one thing, we are making these tones and we're totally unconscious of all of this. So in my work now, it's a major concern to try to compose consciously with these factors. And now is really the first time, actually, that it's possible, and that's because you're able to make a sufficient program to study these things in a conscious way, other than improvising and hearing nice tones and saying, oh, gee, this is good, this does something to me. You can really make a very objective music from this. And in my own work, I do work very objectively like that, and I work a lot with the second factor of our sense as human responders is what acousticians call pattern modulation or auditory beats in the brain. And as far as I know, it's not exactly clear what the research has not knowledge of what actually is sounding, if it's some resonance in the neurons or not, but how this, the specific example of this is, if you take a tuning close to the fifth octave or fourth, and you arrange the beats so that they become very slow, and they're slowing down, there are many patterns. And I had brought an article from Scientific American that I was going to project of a study that was made binaurally where people experienced different shapes. Now, I had always done this when I began composing, but I had many strange names for these effects. So when I finally found some articles, they were very helpful to me because I knew that I was not listening too long, that actually there was fundamental research done, that people hear spirals, they hear curves, they hear various shapes. And this is very simple. In the book of Rodier, he studies the monaural case. And monaurally, if you take the beat at the octave or the fifth or the fourth, you will hear the same shapes and the same patterns, which then tells the acousticians that this is not in the cochlea at all, like the other tones, which are mechanical and are called first-order effects. These are tones that we simply add to the music, from the vibration of our tympanic membrane and the spots on our ear. But the second-order effects are how we're able to extract information and actually make these patterns and these shapes. And without doing it consciously, I, in my own work, often begin this way because I'm able to make very, very nice melodies where they surprise me, and I do it through tuning and through this matter of taking simple intervals and hearing certain shapes. And in terms of our experiences, it really is very, very different because I have made recordings, a complete tape of really fundamentally the same timbres, the same music, really, except for a slight shift in what is phase or these shapes that I'm talking about from actual, whether the wave is very steady or whether it just moves a little bit. And these variations are all very different, how you experience them. They're very different. And this is something I suppose that will be eventually analyzed, how this happens. So I haven't yet made the study for this work, which would be simply stopping at each point and getting the patterns between the very fast beats and the very slow beat when the wave is almost touching and in tune. And the other factor is it's very interesting when you look at the octave in music. I didn't realize I had made some notes a long time ago, and I was actually going to show this because I looked at it the other day, and it's so beautiful. When it's only one octave apart, we have the tones we are sounding in our ear. Let's say if it's two C's, middle C, and two octaves above, we create a G and a C and an E. And then you take it one other octave, and there's an A and a G and a G sharp. And it goes on like this. But when you get to the octave plus five, when it's very low and very high, all the tones we are making in our ear are also C. They're also... I've actually experienced this in tuning, and this is something we can do really electronically that is, to me, quite exciting, that we can't do with instruments. We can actually make these tunings from the very bottom to the very top. And it's a very wonderful experience, and I really wonder, I don't know, I think it's because maybe suddenly at this point you get this sensation of like a pole, and it could be that, it could be because finally at this point we're creating all the C's in response inside our ear, instead of when it's just one C to the next C, we have like three different tones, an E and a G and a B or whatever it is. So maybe it's just my personal, but I think it's very beautiful that that happens. And I think it's unfortunate that all of this has been so buried as psychoacoustic phenomena and called that, and that we're, again, I get back to this thing that as musicians or composers, we're supposed to walk around as kind of dummies, just writing these things and not knowing how they affect any of this. And so now, maybe with programmable instruments, this will become a more conscious factor in composition, and really experiences of this can be enhanced much more for the listener. So I don't know if any of you have any questions right now on that, or if you would rather wait till how long have I been talking? I'm afraid. No, I just am concerned that maybe I'm talking too much. I didn't realize how much more time do we have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Oh, okay. Well, then, all right, quickly, I'll say something then to get into the visual. I myself am very interested in what I think will happen soon. And so I try in some of my pieces where I'm able to make sets. It's like a little make-believe of something I think might be possible in maybe 5 or 6 years. I have a number of friends that are working in this area of virtual environments, it's called, and they work right now. I worked at MIT with Scott Fisher, who's now designed the helmet for the astronauts. That enables you to wear this helmet, and you move your hand, and it's a remote, and it's as though you are in this three-dimensional space. Unfortunately, you have to wear the helmet, but we all dream of the time when actually such a virtual environment could be reconstructed in a room and could simulate the first order of this would be to simulate another another room, another place, another environment, like a photograph, but it would be a virtual construction of this, somehow like a three-dimensional projection. Now, this is a very interesting thing to think about as an artist, because I think the first level, of course, that will happen will be would be able to bring the Bruckner, the Stifter soul space in here and reconstruct it and make this room. But I think even in this first order, there will be difficulties on the level of certain subliminal sounds that really are clues. They are like codes to how we recognize a place or a space. And even though, again, we are not conscious of these kind of tones in the environment, this is, I learned this from actually my environmental work in the with the Boston Harbor. I didn't set out to say, oh, I want to find the resonant frequency or the tone, the hidden tones of these places, but I had it for 2.5 years, and suddenly I realized that there was a whole, like, you know, there was a fundamental tone. There was a tone that was going on that was different than the tone in the space around where I was working, where I was born, where I grew up. And I, also I did a long work with John Cage where Empty Words Close-Up is the name of the work, and the sound recordings I made for that were at Walden Pond, but these recordings were to me nothing. What I did was try to extract on the very subliminal level what the kind of undercurrent or the code of this space was, what I would hear on this most basic level. And I think for recreating the virtual environments in the future in terms of sound and in terms of images, there will be these kind of clues that will have to be worked out, and the knowledge will have to be inserted in the programming to make it a vivid or to make it a very real simulation. And there's a lot of work in this area because a lot of these things are still quite buried. I think in advertising, people are of course, maybe more knowledgeable about this because they, I don't know if they really are, but at least they're interested because they want to manipulate people, maybe into, you know, in order to sell their products. But it's for a different reason. And the second factor, I think, in the virtual environments that will become interesting, once these problems are solved, then if you have like the photograph made of the place, then the artist really has to begin to think of the ways of changing this, the ways of almost as a painter makes paintings of all different scenes doing strange things. Like I can imagine like a Dada period, all these strange things happening with these three-dimensional spaces, but this is after everyone will be very happy that you can have this simulation of this place, and isn't this wonderful? Then the artist will come in and do whatever exotic or curious things, because it will help this situation, because if we live in a world with all these kind of exact simulations, I think it will be, you know, it just will get very boring. And so in the future, I think this will preoccupy, it will be something that people will be involved with. Is, how about the time? Would you?
Some pictures.
Oh,
what
I can
it?
I can just show a few. I just brought a few images here. These are from the work I described, the architectural stagings, and which were in two mini sound series. And these are some examples of some sets. Now you can imagine this. This is an actual stairway. In the room, And this was a duplicate of the couch of Freud with a rug, and the story had to do with these. And so I was using the, this is an emblem of the unconscious on that level. This is another shot. But my friend working in NASA said that you can likes to see these in the sense that they, if you could imagine these as not being a real stairway, but actually being a simulation, this is a real stairway. Oh, did I unplug this? It's not advancing. Oh, I did unplug it. Excuse me, my cable came unplugged. Oh, is it just here? Oh, thanks. And this is the same stairway. And in this, people walked into the space and the sound was staged. This was in San Francisco in the Cap Street, an installation in the Cap Street Gallery. And it is a house, a relatively modern kind of curved house that was designed by David Ireland for this gallery. And artists are invited for 6 weeks to work and 6 weeks to actually create a set. And that's a little child's chair. That's not really how it looked. It was taken by the photographer with the light. It's the same space. But I like to imagine these. Oh, that's the same space, actually, but it's a different light which the photographer added. But I like to imagine these not as, now this is not working, as simulations more than actual buildings, as though, think of them as though we had a simulated environment. And this is in the from an installation in the DID gallery in Berlin, where I did a four-part mini sound series over 4 weeks, and it was called The Music Rooms. And the idea of this work had to do with the power of music and this music that affects us, and we don't know why we like it. We don't know. I mean, we just have this music. So in the hallway, I used two elements. I used props from the German opera warehouse that were, and then the big storage room. Some of them look slightly abandoned. They were used in many productions, and they were props from Das Rheingold, and Salome, and swords from Siegfried, and the head of Johannes from the opera Salome, and a mirror from the opera Lulu. These were elements in the set. And then in the entrance, I had made four large murals of images and texts from the popular music press from England, New Music Express and Melody Maker. And to me, it's again this whole question examining of music, because there's really not a lot of difference between these newsprints from the pop music press and the images of the musicians and their their slogans and their text as in the same kind of power symbols that were in the opera. And so I used the four rooms for this, and this was the entrance to one with the props from Das Rheingold, the gold. And this was the entranceway to the room. And this is another view of it. And this was in another room. This is a real music stand. The rest are projections. And there was a video installation in the room across the hall that had the twin image of this face. And it was in the room on the opposite side of the gallery on a very small monitor in this gold Wagner room. And this was a mirror. This is the mirror from Lula, which you can't see there. And that's more lit. This is the head of Johannes. And this is a projection. And again, a twin face that was on the other side. And here's a bit of the pile of Siegfried, the swords, which can't be seen there. And this was the entranceway with the pop press about music. And then my music, the story of this, was intended to really provoke questions about this, these myths and all of this in music, and why it exists in the world, and why we have it, and why it's in every restaurant. And these are just some video installations where in Berlin, I have written a story about the work of various musicians. It takes place sometime in the future, and they have a laboratory. And of course, this is a wonderful laboratory. It's not like a like a normal. It's really a virtual environment where they would go in, and this would be an actual three-dimensional, and they have things come out of the floor, and they make all their sound researches and their visual researches in this really exotic place. And it's actually like a little bit that exists in medicine right now, when a neurosurgeon, instead of looking... Well, I realized this. I didn't know why I was so intrigued with making their laboratory, and then I realized what it was all about, because right now, to examine, for example, cell structures, you look through a microscope. But imagine if you actually walked into this same structure and it was around you, just as a neurosurgeon does not have to hold up an X-ray and examine the picture. He could actually walk in before the operation to a three-dimensional simulation and sort of practice, well, I'm going to move this and I'm going to change this, you know, in the person's brain that he's about to operate on. He would actually walk into this, the whole geography of the brain, rather than looking at it on a picture. So that's why I decided that's what I was really trying to make with this simulation of this laboratory, which involves these cells that they're studying and all sorts of exotic things, and also art, which is not just hanging on the walls, but might come out of the floor. And so they're better able to study human beings, because I really feel myself that we probably are coming into an interesting time. First, there was the biological revolution, and then the computer revolution. And I think really the next really significant change is going to happen in the science of mind, that it will really be mind science, that finally these tools will enable us to to know much more about our own sensitivity and our experience as human beings. And there's real evidence for this in the sense of the founders of these fields, Francis Crick, who really is dedicated to, Francis Crick, I mean the DNA, the founder of DNA research, who has been for years now in neuroscience and really studying perception. Okay, I know. And the other figure, for example, Marvin Minsky in artificial intelligence, is much more involved in mind science than really hardware and that. And this, to develop this begins with these very basic studies in our perceiving. These are just some more. I think I should stop.
Wow. Oh boy.
Yeah. That was something.
It's great to enter the new year on this kind of a note.
Yeah, to know that you can hear all sorts of things and have all sorts of experiences without needing the spectacular content of Hollywood movies.
Right.
I mean, Tenet was wild, but I'd far prefer to be part of a world where, you know, we sit around in small groups listening to whirling wavelengths.
Tenet was terrible.
Yeah, I especially enjoyed the part where Marianne was talking about the physical length of tones. Like, she's like, so like a middle C is like 3 feet long. And you're like, wow, of course it has a wavelength, but like a distance. Yeah. But I don't think of them in spatial terms at all. I tend to try and close my eyes.
what's interesting, actually, is I used to be a sound guy at a punk bar, basically.
Mm-hmm.
In Toronto.
What was it
and
called?
I learned this. It was called Sneaky D's.
Okay.
And I learned this because there's like the waveform of the specific program material, like the notes themselves or whatever. But there's also like the throw of a speaker cone, which is like the sort of standing point at which the speaker cone, you know, as a parabola sort of projects where it projects the sound to in relation to sort of where it is, the surface of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, like, very popular at the time, I think because of the sort of then ongoing popularity of Steve Albini as a producer, was Ampeg bass stacks. So there's this 8-10 coffin sized 8-10-inch speakers mounted in this extremely deep cabinet body, and it will not fit in any car. It can only be moved by van, which is a remarkable limit on ever wanting to own one. And then you need a powerful enough amplifier head to power it. But the speaker cones in the thing project to literally, I think, something like 4 meters in front of it. So it's not actually very loud right next to it, but it's extraordinarily loud, like 4 meters in front of it. And which is kind of covers the length of a stage, and then sort of like right into the front row of the audience. And I was just like, that is really wild that they would just, you know, it makes sense, I suppose, that they would design this thing to work that way, but that like all the people using them, you know, and this venue was up of quite a flight of stairs. So people would have to carry this stuff up the stairs, you know, and they would have to carry it down the stairs after they'd had several drinks at the end of the night. And it was terrifying to watch people move this stuff around. But all of this stuff has like real physical sort of implications, you know, and it is you can kind of only learn it through fucking around with it, truly.
Mm-hmm.
And having to mess around with it. So I believe that I had no trouble believing that. I was just like, yep. But sorry, finish your thought. Sorry, that was a...
The thought was complete. I just was... it gave me a kind of a visual imaginary of sound that I hadn't had before.
It's like an orchestral chord would go out, but it would be like just like a bunch of hands reaching out from the orchestral pit kind of thing to different lengths.
Yeah, at some point, you know, I saw like a air pressure density map of sound waves, which felt better than like the kind of sinusoidal representation of sound waves. So I think of it like, to me, I always envision sound kind of like the opening scene of Gladiator.
I've never seen it.
Okay. He's like, I think it ends up being the opening and the closing, you know.
All I know is the "Are You Not Entertained" meme.
I don't know that one, but anyhow, he's just like waving, rubbing his hands across like a field of wheat that is blowing in the wind, and you can see like kind of the tips of the wheat move, you know, get closer and further, and that's how, like, three-dimensional wheat in the wind. That's how I envision sound.
Well, that's awfully poetic.
Yeah, yeah, it's straight up communist, you know, because the wheat feeds the people. Just like sound.
I too am Spartacus.
You too, Brutus?
I as well am Spartacus. That's wild. Yeah.
But we
what else did you like?
We did want to plug plug our friend of the show, Micah Silver, plug his his audio gallery called Black Hole, that is based just south of Los Angeles. You can visit his website at www.blackhole.la, and unfortunately cannot schedule a visit quite yet because of COVID-19. But soon enough, there's an incredible library of audio works from 1950 to the present, including Marianne's, who explore these ideas of sound and space and psychoacoustic experience.
And there's incredible stuff in the space. There's a Meyer sound audio system in there, I believe. There is a Linux computer as well, controlling the DAC, which makes me feel really good.
Yeah.
I feel really good to know that this is going through Pulse Audio or Jack. Mm-hmm. The two Linux playback multi-channel playback managers that are probably going to be employed. And wow, this is just great.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is exciting.
Yeah. There's also a community noise service that you can rent for free to help amplify your cause. So if you're protesting or doing some such thing, you can check out, if you will, the equipment from him. To amplify your cause.
Well, and I think also if you have questions about construction noise or other industrial noise near your area, you know, if you are the victim of bad corporate activity, for example, they can help you with that as well.
It just, yeah, it's all around good thing. So check out the Black Hole. Inspired directly by the work of Marianne Amiche, who Micah studied with and was close friends with.
Right. Well, it's almost the new year. Do you have any resolutions before we convene again in 2021, Nicholas?
Not yet.
Do you make resolutions? Or are you perfect?
I don't think those are the only two options.
I feel like that's the only two options. You either like commit to changing or you're like, nope, I'm fine.
Yeah. I guess there's a reason for this, but I find that I just have the most pedestrian of New Year's resolutions. Like, I want to drink less or I want to like work out more or something.
That's not nothing, you know. Those are things that you know, I'll be honest, like I wanted to become a more powerful cyclist.
Mm-hmm.
And it only really kicked into gear for me truly once I got back to Los Angeles, I think, because the rewards of long distance cycling are so great here compared to other places.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can just see so many different things and be in so many different kinds of places so quickly, you know, over the course of a 60, 80, 100 kilometer bike ride here, which in lots of parts of the world, you know, it's just like it's a more kilometers of fields or it's more kilometers of, you know, there's kind of like the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the same kinds of industry or the same kinds of activities people are doing. And here there's such a wide variety and you can go from the beach to the mountains and stuff like that. And it's truly, which is truly possible in the scope of a day on a bicycle. So it's the kind of thing where like, when the rewards really started coming, being, you know, but even in Austin where I started the year, you know, and that really came true, I think, this year for me. This year I've decided to stretch more.
Oh, okay.
That's my resolution. I'm going to try and make sure that I spend enough time, you know, and I think that the amount of time that it will truly take to sort of conquer sort of consistent pain in the organism increases as you age. So I feel like I should start regularly stretching a significant amount in the mornings. So that's my only resolution. And so like you, you know, drink less, work out more, you know, pretty pedestrian, but I think, you know, stay hydrated, stretch more.
Yeah. Stay healthy.
Yeah, you can't argue with that. Those are the kind of resolutions that I think you're likely to, you know, especially once you start seeing benefits from them, I think they're likely to stick.
Yeah.
As opposed to like things that you really can't control. You know, like,
well, I feel
be
like
a nicer person.
You know, if New Year's came at a different time of the year, I'd have a very different tune, because I feel like it comes, I must admit, patting myself on the back, I've been pretty good about like riding the exercise bike and lifting weights and doing like aerobics this whole year. But then New Year's always comes right after there's been like a stretch of like giant meals. And we were out in the desert with my parents, so I don't have like the exercise bike or the desire or means to exercise in the way I do at home. So it always comes after like a 2 week spell of gorging.
Yeah.
But I will say, you know, due to,
well, you see yourself at your worst.
Right. But due to COVID-19, we ate our giant Christmas Eve and Christmas Day dinners at 2 o'clock, which I think is just far better for the human organism to eat your big meal in the afternoon.
This is what they say. Yeah. And I have to say that the same is true of my holiday festivalizing as well. The big meal happened, you know, while the sun was up.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely digest it by the time you go to bed.
Yeah.
It's like much easier to go to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. I wake up feeling just like, you know, normally hungry and ready to tackle the day.
Yeah, as opposed to some sort of victim.
Yeah, victim of like nocturnal digestion.
Yeah, exactly. Well, all right, so with those resolutions, and I hope some of your own of a suitably modest yet salutary nature, we'll see and you'll hear from us. Should an asteroid not strike the Earth or something in 2021.
Good morning, Chinatown.
Good riddance, 2020.